Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Listen to KMOX anytime, anywhere. Download the radio.com app today.
I'm a Trumpocrat.
That's right.
If I have the ability to vote, I'm going to vote for him.
You cannot make a brilliant speech where they say that was such an incredible, elegant speech if I'm talking about dishwashers, sinks, toilets, light bulbs.
Now, Mark Reardon.
You're a lying, dog-faced pony soldier.
On St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Well, clearly we need to come up with some new open bites for the show, and I think we're working on that. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. A beautiful day in St. Louis before some of the winter weather kicks in once again, and a lot to cover this afternoon, especially because we have a new administration. Joe Biden is the new president. He was inaugurated yesterday, and we know that with a new president, we'll have new intensity on the part of the media. The media is going to be as rapidly intense as they were during the last 4 years, asking all kinds of important questions. So we have a new press secretary. I'm going to give you an example of this. Jen Psaki, who is, who do we have up there? Sarah, and then, well, there are a bunch of them, right? Spicy was up there. We'll see how long Jen Psaki lasts. But listen to the, I don't think she's going to last that long. Based on the tone in the White House briefing room this morning, Dave, let's roll the tape.
Will he keep Donald Trump's Air Force One color scheme change?
This is such a good question. I have not had the opportunity to dig into that today, given the number of executive actions, orders, the inauguration, a few things happening. I will venture to get you an answer on that, and maybe we can talk about it in here tomorrow.
Damn it, I hope so. I cannot believe she didn't have that answer ready to go, but we can hold out hope that we're going to have that for tomorrow. And then you have Mayor Pete. Mayor Pete's going to be the transportation secretary, right? I warned you yesterday, and this is already happening. I mean, I think some people might think this is an exaggeration. Everything for the next 4 years is going to be framed around race and gender. Everything. You don't believe me? Here's Mayor Pete.
I believe good transportation policy can play no less a role than making possible the American dream. Getting people and goods to where they need to be, directly and indirectly creating good-paying jobs. But I also recognize that, at their worst, misguided policies and missed opportunities in transportation can reinforce racial and economic inequality by dividing or isolating neighborhoods and undermining government's basic role of empowering Americans to thrive.
There you go. Thank you, Mayor Pete. Frame roads around race and gender moving forward. That's going to be awesome. On the topic of the executive orders, one of the executive orders was to kill the Keystone Pipeline. Makes no sense whatsoever. It's a job killer right out of the gate. Even Senator McCaskill supported, took her a while. She didn't come along very quickly because she was afraid to go up against Obama, but she even, in the end, supported the Keystone Pipeline that now Joe Biden is apparently going to put the kibosh in. We're going to talk with Daniel Turner from Real Clear Energy. He's the co-founder and executive director of a group called Power the Future. Josh Hamber will be here this afternoon. I love Josh. I kind of discovered him last year late. He's the Newsweek magazine opinion editor, and he's kind of conservative. I mean, he raises some pretty good points here about some things moving forward that should get some coverage. So Josh is going to join me. Also, we'll have State Senator Bill Igel this afternoon. And Andy Sims, who's a lead agent at Young Money Football. They have Jalen Hurts and a bunch of others. We're going to talk NFL playoffs this afternoon. Hey, Dave, roll that song Undivided from Tim McGraw that was featured during the inauguration last night. Let's hear this. This is Tyler Hubbard and Tim McGraw. and a song that they did down in Nashville that aired during all the festivities last night. Undivided. I think you can kind of get the gist of where this song is going.
He really got picked on in school for things he couldn't change. He tried his best to play.
Notice how I hit the post on that, Klein? Smash that one, having only heard the intro one time. I bring
it up
because I know. I said, you know, yesterday was National DJ Day. Did you know that? It was National DJ Day, and I started as a DJ. Oh, yeah. It's a national day. And I had my friend John was texting me. He says, a couple of DJ facts that you might not be aware of. Being a DJ requires being a person in a highly skilled technical art form. Who knew? It has deep history and takes hours of practice, which needs a high level of musical knowledge. Didn't know that either. Walter Winchell coined the term disc jockey in the 1930s. And here's one. The salary of a professional disc jockey can range from $10 to $124, depending on their experience. That's pretty accurate.
Well, that is
I think the range. That's what he, $10 to $124. I don't know if that was supposed to be $10,000 to $124,000, but I think $10 to $124 is more likely. The reason I bring up Undivided, I had no idea, but Shane Drake is a great music producer. He does music videos. He's got a company called Say So Pictures in Los Angeles, and he's won all kinds of awards. He's worked with Panic at the Disco, Fall Out Boy, Carrie Underwood. He did this video years ago with Tim McGraw and Taylor Swift and Keith Urban, Highway Don't Care, which is a great song from 2013. It won the CMA Video of the Year, won the ACM Video of the Year, and apparently Tim called him and had him come to Nashville for what aired last night. So we're going to talk to Shane a little bit later on this afternoon. It hurts because about a year ago, I think I sort of even talked about this a little bit on the air. When Peter Frampton came to St. Louis most recently, it was a great anniversary for Bob Heil as well. Bob started as an engineer at KMOX, went on to be an audio pioneer, and created that that crazy sound that Peter Frampton and Joe Walsh used in a few songs that people kind of know. And Frampton Comes Alive went just epically, you know, out of control with sales and still is. And Bob's story is fascinating. He's been on the air for many years. Used to be on the air, of course, with Jim White way, way back in the day. And as I was listening to Bob's story, I thought, well, this first of all, people tell him all the time, I mean, why don't you write a book? And I said, how about a documentary? So we got some of the forces together and Shane was on board. And then there was a worldwide pandemic. So that whole thing went belly up, unfortunately. And it kind of makes me a little sick to my stomach thinking about it. Anyway, we got a lot to get to this afternoon, including an audio cut of the day. I came across some audio yesterday, and I thought this was interesting because there is a feeling moving forward, and I've seen even some of the coverage on Twitter so far that how different really, and this is what drew people into Trump because he wasn't the establishment. So there's this feeling now that everyone's on the same page and the fix is in, Democrats, Republicans. When you really separate the establishment of those two parties, how different are they? So somebody posted this from George Carlin, who was a great, great angry comedian. Of course, he did the seven words you can't see on television. Remember, my dad had that record, and I would listen to it. He did not know I was listening to it, and I was listening to profanity. It's probably where my love and passion for profanity really started in the late 1970s. And I went and saw George Carlin at the Kiel Opera House when I turned 18 years old. I was surprised by a friend of mine who went, sat in the second row. So I'm a huge George Carlin fan. And this is sort of bipartisan, what you're going to hear from George Carlin. This is one of those things that, and he obviously was, his style of comedy was, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Because he would rant and rave, and you're going to hear the anger in George Carlin when he talks about basically politicians and how things work.
They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they're getting f***ed by a system that threw them overboard 30 years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
Well, something tells me that George Carlin would have, I'm not going to say he would have been a Trump supporter, but certainly he was concerned about some of the same issues that I think a lot of people across the country certainly got behind the former president about. And he went on here, the rant went on from Carlin.
You and I are not in the big club. By the way, it's the same big club they use to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head in their media, telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged. And nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hardworking people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hardworking people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich who don't give a about them. They don't give a about you. They don't give a f- about you. They don't care about you at all, at all, at all. Yeah. You know? And nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on. The fact that Americans will probably remain willfully ignorant of the big red, white, and blue that's being jammed up their every day. Because the owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it.
Yeah, there you go, George Carlin. I'm trying to figure out, Dave, do you remember when that was from? I'm seeing a couple of references. Might have been from 2005 in an HBO special. Yeah, it looks like maybe that was it. And when I saw him at the Opera House in, boy, this would have been 83, I'm guessing, 80, yeah, probably 1983. 82, 83, right around there. He was getting ready for an HBO special at the time, in the beginning, early days of cable. And I might be misremembering this because, you know, it was a long, long time ago, but I think he did like 2.5 hours or something like that, maybe even longer. I saw Robin Williams one time and he did 3 hours. And I don't even think it was cocaine infused at the time that I saw him. And that was just crazy to see a comedian do that much. I had it coming to me because I paid a lot for that Robin Williams ticket. And one of the other scandals today, and I'm going to just go on the record here saying this is probably one of the biggest issues that I would take, even outside of the Keystone Pipeline or some of the other things that the Biden administration has already done. Listen to this. Now, I'd heard some references, didn't know if it was true. Apparently, Trump had a button that was installed, a little red button that was installed by the desk. And every time he'd press it, there would be a butler that would come into the Oval Office. Apparently, this is true. And they would bring a Diet Coke in on a silver platter. Well, President Biden, yeah, wouldn't that be great, Dave? I need one of those. First of all, see, that's my question. If this is un-American to get rid of the Diet Coke button, I don't know how you could do that. And meantime, how do I get one?
I think the next time you're back in studio, I think you should demand that from management here. I think it's only right.
Absolutely. I can't even believe it. It's kind of like the Matt Lauer button, but different, right?
Oh, that's a good one.
We'll leave it at that. 217, we'll talk about the Keystone Pipeline coming up next on KMOX.
Now, more of Mark Reardon on News Radio 1120 KMOX.
It's 220 at the Voice of St. Louis, and one of the first actions we heard about from the new Biden administration is revoking the permits for the Keystone XL Pipeline by executive order. I hadn't even heard about the Keystone Pipeline for a while because Trump kind of put it back into play. It was a hot issue during the Obama administration. We talked to Daniel Turner this afternoon, who wrote about this. He is the executive director of a group and a founder of a group called Power of the Future. Daniel, welcome to KMOX. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, where should we start here? Maybe with the question of why this was so important for Joe Biden to do this right out of the gate, in your opinion.
Yeah, It's a great question, and it's weird that Keystone has been this political football for nearly a decade when it is, relatively speaking, a fairly basic infrastructure project, right? America has 3 million miles almost of oil and gas pipelines crisscrossing it. We have enough pipeline in this country to go to the moon and back 10 times. So what is the controversy over this particular pipeline? It has been, like I said, a political football. Obama dealt with it. Trump dealt with it. And now it's back in Biden's turn to run with it. And it's really unfortunate because this should be a relatively simple project.
So what is the Keystone Pipeline right now? How is it functioning, or how has it been functioning? Because I remember this debate from many, many years ago. I think a lot of people do. And I remember pressing former Senator McCaskill on this because for a while she was not decided. And then, if I remember correctly, she actually supported advancing the Keystone Pipeline. So as a supposed moderate Democrat, she voted in favor. So how much has it been operating? And then when this thing gets canceled, what happens?
Yeah, it has been operating since President Trump finally gave the green light. And it was going to take a while to build, right? It is a 1,200-mile pipeline. It's coming from several hundred miles north of the Canadian border, and it's running through multiple states, going all the way down to Houston. But it has employed in the process over 10,000 different people, currently around 3,000 people. And then estimates are that 1 degree off of that, tens of thousands of people. So these are real folks in North and South Dakota and Kansas and Nebraska who, you know, Joe Biden talks about these blue collar union, good paying jobs. Well, he just eliminated them with the stroke of a pen, thousands of them. And no one's there, right? Where's CNN? Where's MSNBC? Where's anyone sitting at the kitchen table? Yeah. These folks, they don't have a voice anymore, and that's shameful.
I think it's shameful, too. And just as a point of clarification, so how much of the pipeline has been completed at this point?
Most of it, actually. Quite a bit of it. Coming from Canada, crossing the American border. Not enough to have the entire thing finished, of course. But like I said, it was a major infrastructure project, and it was a green project. Because what's greener than a pipeline, right? If we're going to transport oil and gas, it's going to get transported somehow. So now what? Do they put it on rail? Do they put it on trucks? Well, pipelines have no emissions. And so if you care about the environment, you're now getting rid of a green solution to go to a less green solution. So there's no environmental decision here. There's no economic decision. This is just pure stupid politics.
It's political. Yeah, it's political because people know the Keystone Pipeline. They know that name. They know it was a controversy. And this is about virtue signaling to the progressives that we're going to do something about emissions or whatever the reason at this point. Now, once it's dead at this point, what's the potential of bringing it back? I mean, I suppose if there's a Republican back in the White House, or are there other avenues?
Well, I know the Trudeau administration in Canada said they wanted to talk further. I am sure the company will go to the courts, right? If I've invested tens of millions of dollars into this pipeline, having followed all of the right channels, right? They went through the necessary paperwork. They got the right permitting. Obama never said no. He just punted. He punted and he punted and he punted. And then Trump said, okay, fine, let's just finally do this darn thing. So if I'm the owner of this company and I have shareholders and I have fiduciary responsibility and I have employees who I love, well, I feel like I'm going to go to the courts and fight for it, because otherwise, what's the statute of limitations for an executive order, right? Can we revoke the Brooklyn Bridge? I mean, that was built. Maybe we should shut that thing down, right? How far back can a president go with stopping business when it went through the proper legitimate channels?
And I'm glad that you brought up the media aspect of this, because, and this is, you know, a constant theme on this show, and I even saw... Here's something interesting. Let's kind of share this, because maybe the number is too low. 56% of Americans agree with the statement that journalists and reporters are purposely trying to mislead people by saying things they know are false or gross exaggerations. I would put, and this is something I've always done, Daniel. Look, as you know, you're a guy who writes and you deal with news. It's sometimes what you don't report as well, and this is a good example of that.
Absolutely, right? This is an example of the media foregoing the opportunity to go to Nebraska and talk to these folks and sit at their kitchen table, right? The media loves the sob story. They love the human interest story. They particularly love it when it's a cause they care about. So how many immigration stories do we hear about at the border? How many stories do we hear about of elderly who have COVID and they try to blame the president on all these things? Well, these are our fellow Americans, too, and their job, their livelihood was changed in a day. And is there a GoFundMe page, right, to pay for their underwater mortgage? Is there a GoFundMe page for their kids' college tuition? So this is an industry. The energy industry has been one that, for some weird reason, the media and the political elite and the Hollywood elite love to be able to just crap all over without realizing that it is literally millions of our fellow Americans whose lives are affected by it.
Daniel Turner with me, Director of Power of the Future. What happens to the oil? I mean, Canada's going to sell it somewhere, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. If I'm Justin Trudeau and I have a Canada first mentality, which he should, right? He's the Prime Minister of Canada. I never will to this day. Maybe our kids one day will explain to us. I never to this day will understand why America first was met with such loathing disdain by the American left. I don't know what's controversial about that, but Canada first.
Not me neither.
Justin. Yeah, and that should be Justin Trudeau's priority. So he's going to find another market. So if I am the Prime Minister of Canada, rather than go south to Houston, I will go west to our ports in British Columbia, and I will put it on a barge, and I'll send it to China, I'll send it to India, I'll send it somewhere else, because I have to protect my economy and my people.
You know, the other thing, and this is a whole other segment, so maybe we have you back at some point. The other thing that's going on right now, obviously, is the reentry to the Paris Climate Accord, which presents a whole other set of economic issues for this country.
Absolutely. And again, we exceeded the goals of the Paris Climate Accord without being in them. So now we're going to join this cabal, really, which puts America on the line for billions of taxpayer dollars that will be controlled by the United Nations, right? $3 billion now we will be, as an agreement, be sending for the UN Energy Program to distribute as they see best. Well, isn't that luxury? You know, I know what they're doing tonight. They're going to Morton's and buying steak because they just got a $3 billion investment from the Biden administration, right? So it puts us on the hook for all of these protocols and these requirements without any consideration for whether or not this is good for America. And it ignores China, it ignores India, it ignores Pakistan, it ignores Russia. They just said, screw this, I'm not joining that accord. So if the world's largest polluters are not part of it and they're not subjugating their economy to it, why is America, right? Why are we doing this? Well, we're doing this because this is the way people like Joe Biden and John Kerry, globalists with progressive agendas, this is how they think.
Come on, Daniel, you just have to have the full faith and confidence that CNN and the New York Times and the Washington Post are going to vet this appropriately. They're going to have good conversations with all sides here moving forward. You're too negative, Daniel Turner.
I am. I need more trust in John Kerry, because so many times in the history of our country have we seen a problem and said, let's get John Kerry on it and then we'll fix the problem.
Yeah, he'll probably be back. Give it time. Daniel Turner, I appreciate your time this afternoon on KMOX. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kerry reference, I mentioned Senator McCaskill. One time I went to Washington and Senator McCaskill was giving me a tour and we ended up on like one of those trams with Senator Kerry, which was, well, he was Secretary of State at the time, which was kind of bizarre, especially because I was eavesdropping just a little bit. That's a good story. 2:30 at the Voice of St. Louis, Josh Hammer, Newsweek magazine's opinion editor, coming up next after the news on KMOX.
News Radio 1120, KMOX, the voice of the Cardinals.
Well, I can't believe all the things that have happened here in the last couple of weeks. I think I'm most upset about the Diet Coke button being removed from the Oval Office. That is un-American, unacceptable, and honest to God, I really want to find out how I can get one, because that's a great feature. And Dave, thank you so much for inspiring me. When I'm allowed back in the studio on a regular basis, when we can actually pull this off, and I was hoping it was going to be February, but the way things are going with COVID, I'm not sure. We are definitely installing that one in the KMOX studio. Newsweek magazine's opinion editor Josh Hammer is back with me this afternoon to talk about a bunch of different topics. Are you a Diet Coke guy, Josh, or not?
I'm actually not really a big soda, pop, whatever you want to call a guy myself, to be honest with you. I drink a lot of water or a lot of coffee and no shortage of whiskey, and those are kind of my vices.
Oh, there you go. Well, unfortunately, I'm a Diet Coke addict, and it's not good for you. I know that, but it is what it is. How are you doing in this new year? And I know I've written or I've read a couple of the columns that you've written. Maybe we should go back a couple of weeks because I know you had some strong feelings on what happened on January 6th, and we'll kind of get to what happened yesterday and the executive orders and stuff. But I was rather disgusted with the past couple of months, including with my friend Senator Hawley here in Missouri, and I don't know how this is all going to play out, even moving into the future.
Yeah, so thanks so much for having me on, Mark. I actually disagree a little bit when it comes to Senator Hawley. I prudentially disagree. I think that that was the wrong manner in which to bring a claim like that. I'm currently the opinion editor of Newsweek, right? But I'm actually a constitutional lawyer by training. This is kind of my wheelhouse. In a situation such as this, where there are widespread irregularities, peculiarities, there's mail-in balloting questions, rejection rates, the proper avenues the Constitution affords, the remedial measures, are on the one hand, of course, litigation. You can always pursue that track in the courts. And what you can also do is you can convene at the state level, because the states are ultimately responsible for certifying their electors, the Electoral College, according to statutory law. It's always December 14th each year. The states can convene commissions to investigate this sort of thing at the state legislature level. And if need be, they can actually then send competing slates of electors to the Electoral College, which is something that's happened actually any number of times. The election of 1876 is the best example of that. The issue for what happened this year is that no Republican held state legislature got their act together in time, so to speak. That didn't happen. On December 14th, the Electoral College slate was 306 to 222 in the count, which ended up, 232, which ended up being the final count. So this January 6th process, which is traditionally viewed as being just purely ritualistic and symbolic, was not the proper means to address these concerns. They should have been aired earlier. On the merits, Senator Hawley, I think specifically, was objecting to what happened in Pennsylvania, which is pretty, at least from my perspective, was the clearest cut state that blatantly did not follow its own election law. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court had a flagrantly unconstitutional rule in there that the U.S. Supreme Court unfortunately failed to hear the case of. So I think I disagree with the way in which you raised it, but on the substance, I didn't really have an objection. All that said, though, President Trump's conduct was obviously appalling. It was obviously appalling on January 6th. It was an irresponsible decision to hold that rally at that time and place in the first instance. His failure to immediately and quickly and unequivocally condemn what was going on at the Capitol, eventually he did, of course, but his failure to immediately do so, I thought, was pretty dire.
I agree.
Let me
stop you there, though. On the thing with Hawley, I understand what you're saying, and I always allowed for the irregularities to be investigated. The issue that I had with Senator Hawley and others is that they led people down this path to believe that something could be done after December 15th or whenever the electors were slated. And I thought that was what was most objectionable to me, especially because, and Josh, so I've known Senator Hawley for a long time. He was on my show maybe even 10 years ago, and I brought him in as the official. He had an intro and everything, and that's very special. We might be able to get you one. He was the official constitutional law expert of the Mark Reardon Show. He clerked for the, for the Chief Justice, well, John Roberts at the time, and he was solid on this, and I like his philosophy, and we're on the same side with many of the issues, but I thought that I had to retract that because, he was leading people down a path constitutionally that wasn't, there was no path constitutionally on January 6th.
Right. So there really wasn't. And I do not disagree with you on that. John Eastman is a friend of mine. He's a formerly clerk for Clarence Thomas. He's affiliated with the Claremont Institute. He was one of the president's lawyers throughout all this litigation. He had an interesting piece the other day, basically arguing that the vice president's role in quote unquote certifying electoral college returns is necessarily a little bit more than purely symbolic, which is what I was saying earlier. And to an extent, that's correct, right? I mean, in a situation where they actually submit competing slates of electors, it does seem like it is the vice president following a debate of the Congress who is constitutionally bestowed with the decision to choose which elector is fully legitimate. But But again, I think you and I are on the same page insofar as the states didn't do their job here. They didn't actually send competing slates of
let me go back a step before that, because and I've been trying to find out more information about this. You hear competing information. I've read a bunch of pieces. But with Act 77 in Pennsylvania in particular, couldn't that lawsuit have been filed well before even Election Day?
Totally. There was a huge failure here on the part of, you know, local Republican parties, local Republican lawyers, activists. Republicans, and, you know, I've been a registered Republican since the day I turned 18, so I can kind of just say we here. I think we were really kind of caught off guard, which is unfortunate because it was so readily foreseeable. I mean, as soon as kind of COVID hit, we knew that mail-in balloting would occur. You know, at Newsweek, I hold these kind of debates of the week. It's kind of like a point counterpoint op-ed kind of thing. I held a debate on mail-in balloting last June. I mean, a long time ago. So we really should have had this litigation well out in front of November. And to be clear, sometimes there was. Some of that did exist, but it clearly did not happen the extent to which it ought to have happened. And look, this notion, again, that the vice president can just kind of thumbs up, thumbs down, single-handedly overturn the Electoral College where the states themselves have not even submitted competing slates of electors, that's a lie. We should feel comfortable calling that a lie. To the extent that anyone was complicit in that, they should be criticized, they should be held accountable, and so forth. The president, I think, certainly holds the most responsibility there out of anyone.
I think we agree on that, right? Yeah, Josh Hammer, opinion editor at Newsweek. So let's kind of push it forward here, and where, from a couple of different perspectives, where does the populism go, especially if Donald Trump doesn't have a voice out there on social media? There's still people, and now you have millions of people who feel like they've been labeled as racists and, you know, bigots and all this stuff. So where does that channel itself moving forward, especially because it's complicated with Trump not really having a voice right now?
It's a really great question. I mean, this is kind of one of the million-dollar questions that we're kind of sorting out in real time as we speak. Look, from my perspective, Mark, my perspective on this is that there's no going back to the way things used to be. I think Trump, it took someone of his formidable stature, someone with all the marketing talent, the charisma, no matter what you might say about his, you know, various insecurities and faults, his fame, and the fact that I think he did not mature through the institutions of conservatism, right? He was a true outsider. It took someone like that to kind of break through the Republican Party and I think make a lot of conservatives rethink a lot of kind of the old orthodoxies that have become stale and cobwebbed over time that don't necessarily as readily apply to our circumstances in the year 2021 as they applied in the Reagan-Bush platform of 1984 when they kind of reached their zenith. And I think he was deeply effective in doing so. So now we're kind of in the phase where we're trying to turn, quote unquote, Trumpism, which really is kind of just a more nationalist, populist kind of form of conservatism. From my perspective, from my reading of history of conservatism, I think it's, for the most part, a truer version than kind of the more dogmatic, you know, free trade is the greatest thing ever version of conservatism that we were sold for decades. But now we need to kind of take that and use our institutions, our the media, use all the levers at our disposal to actually craft a policy agenda, ideally with, from my perspective, ideally without Trump being the sole figurehead. Because after January 6th, I just don't think he's well equipped to do that.
Yeah. On your thoughts on what's happened here, let's talk this, the new administration. So one of the last things that they did, I know you're passionate about this, is the State Department declared that the Chinese government is committing genocide and crimes against humanity with the Muslim ethnic minorities. And then you have all the executive orders that come in yesterday. So let's talk about China first. Is this something that will be also continued by this administration?
Gosh, you know, I hope so. I would encourage your listeners to, if I could just do a bit of a self-plug, to go to our Newsweek opinion page, because literally just this morning we had Gordon Chang, who's probably, for what my money's worth, my single favorite China-related commentator in the current discourse right now. He actually has an op-ed on this precise issue, kind of urging the Biden administration to continue Secretary of State Pompeo's very bold, courageous, and I would say accurate designation that the Chinese Communist Party is committing genocide in Xinjiang. This is a huge deal, Mark. We don't know everything, obviously. There's a lot we don't know because China's infamously tight-lipped about what they do internally. They don't allow in international investigators or things of that nature. But what we know is deeply harrowing stuff. And, you know, look, I don't generally like to invoke this when it's not directly relevant. But look, you know, I mean, I am Jewish. I've been to Yad Vashem, Israel's, the state of Israel's Holocaust Museum numerous times. It is kind of our responsibility to call out what clearly does appear to be a genocide, even if it's not in quite as sprawling a scale as Nazi-era Germany, when we see one. And it would just be truly, truly abhorrent, I guess the word I would use, for the Biden administration to rescind Pompeo's courageous designation in order to pursue, you know, liberalized trade or commerce or just friendly diplomatic relations, whatever he might choose to prioritize. Something of this nature, Mark, simply has to take priority. It just must.
But isn't it also fair to criticize the Trump administration for not doing this sooner?
Absolutely. Totally correct. I wrote a column last week urging Trump to kind of officially diplomatically recognize Taiwan as an independent state on the way out the door. Another thing that I don't understand why he didn't do sooner. I think it was right when he was inaugurated in January 2017, he became the first U.S. president since the U.S. de facto adopted the so-called One China policy in 1979. He was the first U.S. president to accept a congratulatory phone call from a Taiwanese official. So it was all laid out for him quite clearly to do that. And I am actually very disappointed that he did not do that. Similarly, I think it's totally fair game to criticize him for not doing that in Xinjiang early enough. I mean, we've known about this for at least a year and a half now, probably closer to two and a half years. So that's totally fair game, I think.
So on the executive order time earlier this hour on Keystone, that seems like a purely political move. We're going to see this, though. And I've said, and I think I've seen your tone on your tweets and some of your pieces, it seems like everything is going to be framed around race and gender moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like we're kind of, you know, if I can just kind of like wax philosophical for a second here. America is traditionally a religious society. Okay. If I can say something that is kind of just a bit of a truism, we're all familiar with the founding quotes, George Washington's farewell address, where he says that, a free society cannot endure without morality, and religion has always been understood as the best safeguard of morality. Just a few years later, John Adams says that the Constitution was made for a religious and moral people. It is wholly inadequate for everyone else. But, and, you know, while a tight-knit group of, evangelical Protestants, devout Catholics, Orthodox Jews, et cetera, those groups have definitely endured. And if anything, they've actually proliferated. Orthodox Judaism is actually the fastest growing sect of Judaism in America, which is wonderful. But at the same time, the overall percentage of Americans who are religious has just gone down, right? And I say all that as just a bit of a wind up to the notion that when you lose a sense of belief in God, when you lose a sense of religion and purpose in kind of a more transcendental sense, you need something that to kind of come in and take the place of that. And it never can truly meaningfully do so, but you're going to need some sort of ersatz religion, I guess you would say, to kind of come in and give you pseudo meaning. And I think what's going on with race in America right now, this kind of racial reckoning, is exactly that. I think this is a lot of way for a lot of, largely speaking, probably less devoutly religious Americans to kind of feel like they're kind of getting their spiritual religious fix in. It's through this great racial reawakening in the aftermath of George Floyd and all the riots this summer. And we kind of saw some allusions to that in Joe Biden's inaugural address. And I think that's going to be a recurrent theme for the next 4 years. I wish it weren't so, but I do see it being so.
Yeah, that's an interesting analogy. And I'd love to think about that one a little bit more. But I think you might be onto something. Josh Hammer, who's the opinion editor at Newsweek. Great stuff. I've been reading it and seeing the tweets. I like a thinking person on the show. So thanks for coming on here this afternoon, Josh. Really appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks so much, Mark.
250 at KMOX. We'll take a break. We got a lot to come here in the 3 o'clock hour. Also, we'll talk with Bill Eigel, state senator from Missouri, on some things going on in Jeff City, in particular on legislative efforts to nullify some of the federal gun laws in the state. And what's that all about? Post-Dispatch has already, I think, pounced on that, but we'll have Bill on in the next hour. Andy Sims, the lead agent at Young Money Football. We're going to talk NFL playoffs and a little bit about the draft and things at 3:30 on KMOX Plus, an audio cut of the day.
KMOX is St. Louis's news, talk, sports, radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you are watching anything on Netflix, if you're streaming Ozark or Cobra Kai or The Queen's Gambit, you are responsible for ruining the planet. Your carbon footprint is, I mean, Greta Thunberg is going to tell us that and I think that Joe Biden in his administration agrees, planet's pretty much got 10 years to go. All right, we got 10 years. So do all your planning. If you need to take trips, you got about 10 years to take that on. Maybe less because of Netflix and Zoom calls. Because here is the study from Purdue University, West Lafayette, Indiana. It's not just to hide clutter anymore. Add, quote, saving the planet, the news release says, to the reasons to leave the camera off during your next virtual meeting. Actually, I kind of like leaving. I think a lot of people like leaving the camera off. But here's what they say. A new study says, despite a record drop in global carbon emissions, yeah, we're leading the world in dropping global carbon emissions, not only because of the pandemic, but because of fracking. That's been a big driver, probably the number one driver. A shift to remote work and more at-home entertainment still presents a significant environmental impact due to how internet data is stored and transferred around the world. So just 1 hour of video conferencing or streaming, for example, emits 150 to 1,000 grams of carbon dioxide. So just to give you an example, a gallon of gasoline burned emits about 8,800 grams. So they're talking 1,000 grams. 1,000 grams just for watching Netflix or TikTok. They have a chart in here. Facebook, not too much, not too bad. The WhatsApp, a little carbon footprint. TikTok, though, that's starting to get pretty big deal. The Zoom calls, that's over 150. And then you get to Netflix. You're ruining the planet with Cobra Kai. That's basically what's happening. What they offer here is streaming content in standard definition rather than in high definition. While using apps like Hulu and Netflix could also bring an 86% reduction. So keep that in mind. Put it back to standard definition so it looks all blurry. That's going to be what's going to save the planet, ladies and gentlemen. Good Lord. Get ready, by the way, for more of this crap for the next 4 years. Total information, PM at 4. Second hour of this show coming up next on KMOX.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.